Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are looking at a stack of notes and articles that honestly feels less like a history lesson and more like the script for a heavyweight boxing match. But the opponents aren't people, they're ideas. And the ring is the human mind.
It really is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the ultimate intellectual cage match of the Middle Ages. You have these two massive heavyweights that everyone just assumed were mortal enemies.
Right. So in the blue corner, you have the rediscovered wisdom of the ancient Greeks, specifically Aristotle. And let's be clear for everyone listening in this time period, Aristotle isn't just a philosopher, he is the philosopher. He's basically viewed as the smartest guy who ever lived.
Exactly. And then in the red corner, you have Christian theology. So the Bible, the church fathers, the whole established framework of faith. And for a really long time, the consensus was just that these two things were like oil and water. They did not mix.
Yeah, if you tried to mix them, you'd probably just end up with an explosion.
Or a heresy trial.
Or that, yeah. But today's deep dive is really about the man who looked at this massive brawl and decided, you know what, I'm going to make these two shake hands. We are talking about Thomas Aquinas. And his mission was to pull off the ultimate synthesis, proving that faith and reason aren't enemies at all, but partners.
It is such a high wire act. And to understand just how dangerous this was for Aquinas, we really have to look at the mess he walked into. Because he was not the first one to try and figure out what to do with Aristotle.
Right. The sources talk about a Muslim philosopher named Averroes. And he was basically an Aristotle superfan, wasn't he?
Superfan is probably putting it mildly. Averroes treated Aristotle as having the absolute best and last word on reality.
Yeah.
I mean, if Aristotle said it, it was true, period. The problem was, Aristotle said some things that made religious people, both Muslims and Christians, very, very nervous.
Give us the highlights on that. What was Aristotle actually saying that was so controversial?
Well, for starters, Aristotle's philosophy implied that the world is eternal. It had just always existed. Which means it wasn't created in the beginning, like the Genesis narrative says.
Okay, yeah, that's a pretty big conflict right off the bat.
It gets worse. Aristotle's system also casts serious doubt on individual immortality. So the idea that your specific personality and soul survive death.
Wow. Okay. So if you're a religious person, those are complete deal breakers. I mean, you can't really have the faith without a creation story or an afterlife. So how did people handle this before Aquinas came along?
Well, Averroes proposed a workaround. It's often called the theory of twofold truth.
This is the part of the reading that honestly drove me crazy. It just feels like such a cheat code.
It does feel that way.
Yeah.
The idea was that there are two totally separate categories of truth. Religious truths are for the masses. They're basically popular language and stories formulated to help everyday people behave. But philosophical truths, those are theoretical, and they are for the intellectuals.
So you could stand in church and say, God created the world and mean it. And then literally walk across the street to the university, say the world is eternal and uncreated, and mean that too.
Precisely. You just hold them in two separate buckets.
That is intellectual schizophrenia. It's like saying, scientifically, I ate the last cookie. But religiously, the cookie is still in the jar. You can't live like that.
It drove the Christian thinkers crazy, too. It's a total lack of intellectual integrity. Many of them, like his contemporary Bonaventure, looked at this mess and said, fine, if this is where Aristotle leads us, we dump him. We're sticking with Plato.
But Aquinas, he doesn't dump him.
No. Aquinas was incredibly stubborn. He looked at Aristotle, and he saw a system of logic that was just too powerful, too coherent, and frankly, too useful to just throw in the trash. He firmly believed that truth was one.
Truth is one. That's the key phrase here.
It absolutely is. If Aristotle is right about reality and faith is right about God, they must fit together. There cannot be a double truth. So Aquinas decides he is going to modify Aristotle to fit the Christian worldview.
Which, if you think about it, takes a massive amount of confidence. Like, yeah, Aristotle was a genius, but let me just fix his homework for him.
It really does.
Yeah.
But Aquinas felt he had the missing piece of the puzzle.
So let's unpack this then. How do you even begin to merge a pagan Greek philosophy with medieval theology? Where does Aquinas actually start fixing the machine?
He starts at the very top with the definition of God.
Okay.
See, for the Greeks and for Aristotle, God was a concept of a supreme being who was the source of order. He organized the universe. He made it beautiful and made it make sense. He's the reason why planets move in circles and why math works.
I hear a but coming.
But, and this is the radical shift, the Greek God was not necessarily the source of existence itself.
Wait, help me distinguish that. What is the difference?
Think of the Greek God as an interior decorator. Or maybe a really good project manager. He arranges the furniture. He organizes the team. He makes the room look beautiful, but he didn't build the house. The stuff that mattered was already there.
Ah, I see. So the universe is like a pile of Legos that was always just sitting there, and God just came along and built the castle.
Exactly. But Aquinas says, no, that's not enough. For a Christian, God isn't just an organizer or a form of all forms. Aquinas argues that God's very essence is to exist. He's the act of being itself. He didn't just arrange the Legos, he made the plastic.
So he completely shifts God from being a manager to being a creator.
Yes. And once you establish that God is the source of all being, you have to explain how he creates. Because remember, Aristotle didn't think creation from nothing was even conceptually possible.
Right. You can't get something from nothing.
This is where Aquinas pulls a brilliant move. He introduces what's known as the Logos doctrine, borrowing heavily from Augustine. And he goes back to Plato's idea of the forms.
The forms. Just as a refresher, these are the blueprints, right? Like the perfect idea of a chair or a tree or a human.
Correct. In Greek philosophy, these forms were just kind of floating out there in the abstract ether. Aquinas takes those cold, abstract forms and he moves them. He says these aren't just floating around. They exist in the mind of God.
That is such a clever bridge. It takes this entirely abstract philosophical concept and gives it a personal home inside theology.
It creates a perfect connection. God has the archetypes, the exemplars for all possible things in his mind. He knows every possibility. He knows what a podcast is perfectly in his mind.
But knowing a possibility isn't the same as making it real. I can imagine a dragon in the studio right now. I have the form of a dragon in my head, but that doesn't mean we're about to get scorched. How does Aquinas get from the idea in God's mind to the actual physical stuff?
This brings us to one of the most difficult, mind-bending concepts in the readings. Materia prima, prime matter.
Prime matter? It sounds like something from a sci-fi movie. Captain the Warp Core needs more prime matter.
It really does sound like that.
Yeah.
Aquinas defines prime matter as pure potentiality. It doesn't actually exist on its own. It is just the absolute bare capacity to become something.
Okay, you're going to have to walk me through this one. How can you have stuff that doesn't exist but has potential? That sounds like a contradiction.
It's definitely tricky. The analogy Aquinas relies on, which the texts specifically highlight, is biological. Think about the reproductive process. Think about a sperm and an ovum.
Okay, I'm with you.
Before they actually meet, they don't have a specific genetic identity as a new, unique human being. They are just potential. They are the possibility of a person.
I follow that.
Form alone, the idea creates nothing. Matter alone, the potential is nothing. It's just a possibility. But when God acts, he brings the form and the matter together to create a substance.
So God is the spark that makes it happen.
He is more than just the spark. He is the fuel and the fire. God gives the actual act of existence to this combination. This is how Aquinas defends creation out of nothing. He's saying that before God acts, there isn't a pile of clay waiting to be molded. Mm. There is only the idea in God's mind and the sheer potential for it to be.
That totally solves the Aristotle problem. Mm-hmm. Because Aristotle thought matter was eternal because he couldn't imagine getting something from nothing. Aquinas is saying, you're right, you can't get something from nothing unless you are being itself.
Exactly. And to prove he's beating Aristotle at his own game, Aquinas uses Aristotle's own framework, the four causes.
Oh, man, I remember this from Philosophy 101. Aristotle said everything has four causes that explain why it exists at all.
Right. So let's play a game with this. Let's apply Aquinas's version of creation to that exact checklist. First up, the efficient cause. The maker. Who is that?
Well, that's God. Easy.
Check. Second, the formal cause. The blueprint. What is that?
That would be the divine reason. The ideas in God's mind. The logos. Check again. Thirteal cause. The purpose. Why make it? To imitate and glorify God.
Perfect. And the fourth one. The material cause. What is the universe made of?
Well, based on what you just said, if God made it from nothing, then the material cause is just nothing.
Bingo. The material cause is none.
That is shockingly bold. He takes Aristotle's own rule book and literally writes N-A in the most important box.
It highlights just how radical this synthesis was compared to the Greeks. And there's a massive takeaway here for us listening today. The Greeks, and honestly, many ancient religions, viewed matter negatively. They saw the physical world as a lack of something or a mistake, or even a prison for the soul.
Right, like the physical body is bad and we need to escape our bodies to be truly spiritual.
Exactly. But Aquinas flips that and views matter positively. Because God created it out of nothing, the physical world is a realized promise. It is potential given existence by God.
Yeah.
It's inherently good.
Which means the physical world isn't a mistake. It's not something to escape from. That actually lays the groundwork for science, doesn't it? If the physical world is good and ordered by God, it's worth studying.
Precisely. He completely validates the study of the natural world. He makes it holy to be a scientist. Now, once he's established this metaphysical foundation that God is the creator and the architect, he moves to the practical application. How do we actually argue this? Which brings us to his greatest hit, the Summa Theologica.
The Summa. Now, the reading described this book in a way that made me laugh. It said it generates simultaneous respect and weariness.
That is a very fair assessment. It's massive. Millions of words. And it's not a book you take to the beach. Think of it more like a massive, rigid training manual for debate.
It's structured almost like a cage match, too.
It is. In the medieval university, teaching happened through public dispute. So the Summa mimics that format. Every single section starts with a question. Then Aquinas lists the objections, which were the arguments against his own view.
Which I love, by the way. He actually steelmans his opponents.
He really does. He makes their arguments as strong as possible. Then he says, on the contrary, where he cites an authority, then I answer it. That which is his main argument. And finally, this is the best part. He goes back and replies to every single objection he listed earlier. He leaves absolutely no stone unturned.
It's the ultimate, I'm not just going to tell you I'm right. I'm going to show you exactly why you're wrong move.
It is incredibly intellectually honest. It's awesome and pedantic and fascinating and tedious all at once. And the biggest question the Summa tackles, perhaps the central question of his entire life, is the relationship between faith and reason. Can we know God just by thinking hard, by using reason alone? Or do we need God to tell us through revelation?
This is the million-dollar question for this whole deep dive. Because if reason is enough, we don't need the Bible or faith. If faith is all that matters, we don't need logic or philosophy or science.
Right. And Aquinas, being the ultimate synthesizer, finds the middle path. He says that natural reason can prove some things. It can prove God exists. It can prove the soul is immortal.
So we can logic our way to God.
To an extent. But reason has limits, serious limits. And those limits come from two specific things, finiteness and fallenness.
Finiteness, I get. We're finite beings trying to understand an infinite God. We just don't have the intellectual bandwidth. It's like a dog trying to understand calculus.
Correct. We just aren't smart enough. But the second limit, fallenness, is much more nuanced. Aquinas draws a very specific distinction between the image of God and the likeness of God.
Okay, unpack that for me, because those sound like the exact same thing to a modern ear.
They do, but for Aquinas, they are crucially different. He argues that the image of God is found in our reason, our intellect. He believes that even after the fall of man, original sin, the apple, all of that, we didn't lose our reason. We aren't fundamentally stupid.
So 2 + 2 still equals 4, even if we are sinners.
Exactly. The machinery of the mind still works perfectly well. But we lost the likeness of God, which is moral perfection. And here's where it gets really interesting. Aquinas says that the loss of moral perfection indirectly breaks our reason.
How so? If the machine works, why is the output wrong?
Because the operator of the machine is biased. We get prejudiced. Our sin and our weakness of will mean we get distracted, or we just don't want to accept a conclusion that is inconvenient for us.
Oh, wow, that hits home. This is motivated reasoning.
It is entirely motivated reasoning.
So it's not that we can't understand the truth. It's that our moral messiness makes us look away from it. We have a dirty lens.
A dirty lens is a perfect way to describe it. And this leads directly to Aquinas' argument for why we need revelation. Mm. Why we need the Bible and faith, even for things we could theoretically figure out on our own using logic.
The notes listed 3 reasons for this, and honestly, they were surprisingly practical. I expected some high-level, impenetrable theology, but he gets really down to earth here.
He does. The first reason is ability. Not everyone is a philosopher. If knowing God required a PhD in advanced metaphysics, most of the human race would be completely left out.
Right. God can't be reserved just for the Mensa Club.
Exactly. Revelation acts as a democratizer. It makes the ultimate truth accessible to everyone, regardless of their IQ.
What's the second one?
The second is time. Aquinas specifically mentions the distractions of youth.
The distractions of youth. I think we all know exactly what he means by that.
We certainly do. Life just gets in the way. Work, family, growing up, trying to make a living. Aquinas realized that if people had to derive the existence of God from scratch, using pure logic, they might never get around to it because they're too busy just surviving and living their lives.
Like, I'd love to contemplate the first mover, but I have to do laundry and pay my taxes.
Precisely. And the third reason is weakness of will. Deep thinking is incredibly hard. logic is demanding. Aquinas says that without revelation, many people would just give up on the hard arguments. They'd lose interest or lose confidence in their own conclusions.
So revelation is basically a safety net. It guarantees that we get the truth even if we aren't smart enough or have enough time or have enough discipline to figure it all out ourselves.
Yes, but he adds one more crucial layer. Revelation also gives us truths that reason simply cannot reach on its own, no matter how smart or disciplined you are.
Like what kind of truths?
Like the Trinity. Or the incarnation, the idea that God became man. Aquinas says reason can get you to the fact that there is a supreme God, but that cannot get you to God is three persons. For that, you absolutely need God to speak up and tell you.
So the grand conclusion here, the final result of this massive intellectual synthesis, is that faith and reason are not opposed at all.
They are partners. Truth is one.
Yeah.
Revelation might go further than reason, but reason can follow right along to confirm and support it. They are climbing the exact same mountain, just using different gear.
It really is an impressive system. He took a world that was literally splitting apart Greek logic on one side, Christian faith on the other, and he stitched it back together.
And he did it by refusing to compromise on either side.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't dumb down the philosophy, and he didn't dilute the theology. He believed that if you think clearly enough and deeply enough, you will find that all truth comes from one single source.
Which brings us back to that twofold truth, that Schrodinger's truth that Averroes proposed. Aquinas just completely slammed the door on that.
He did. He validated the human intellect. He showed that you don't have to check your brain at the door to have faith, because critical thinking and rationality are literally part of the image of God in humans.
Now, before we wrap up this deep dive, there was one final thought from the readings that I found really provocative. It was a comment by a scholar named Ronald Feenstra regarding worldviews. And I think this is where the rubber really meets the road for you listening today.
Ah, yes. The neutrality myth.
Right. Feenstra pointed out that medieval thinkers, and arguably all thinkers, start with an established position. Aquinas started with Christianity and modified Aristotle to fit it. But the suggestion is that everyone does this.
It fundamentally challenges the idea that we can be purely objective observers. We like to think we look at facts neutrally. But the text suggests that no one starts from a view from nowhere.
Right. We all have a baseline.
If you aren't starting with Christian theology, you are starting with something else. Maybe it's materialism or secular humanism or pure skepticism. Mm. And you are likely modifying the facts you encounter to fit that underlying worldview.
We all have a starting point, whether we admit it to ourselves or not. We all have a lens. Aquinas was just very honest about his.
He was. He knew exactly what he believed, and he used reason to support it. He didn't pretend to be a blank slate.
So here is the provocative thought we want to leave you with today. Aquinas knew exactly what his worldview was, and he did the hard intellectual work to make sure his facts and his faith fit together coherently. The question for you is, what is the underlying worldview you are starting with? And when you encounter new facts or new philosophies or new science, are you honestly engaging with them? Or are you just modifying them consciously or unconsciously to fit the picture you already have in your head?
It is the question that defines how we see reality itself.
Thanks for diving deep with us. We'll see you next time.